This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Voters' eyes are on Washington these days as a new Republican-controlled Congress tries to reinvent business as usual in the Capitol. Newsweek's congressional correspondent Stephen Waldman has done a case study of business as usual. He followed one bill from its beginnings as a campaign promise through its passage in Congress. He says he chose President Clinton's National Service Bill because it was a program Clinton hoped would reestablish faith in government. It also tested how Clinton rationalized the two strains of his political personality, his idealism and pragmatism. Waldman's new book is titled The Bill, How the Adventures of Clinton's National Service Bill Reveal What is Corrupt, Comic, Cynical, and Noble About Washington. I asked Waldman to explain how national service was pitched during Clinton's campaign.
Well, the basic idea, it had two parts. He said, everyone should be able to go to college and be able to pay back the college loan money one of two ways, either by doing community service as a teacher or a nurse or a policeman, or by paying back their college loan as a percentage of income over time. That's a student loan reform proposal, basically. And the book follows both of those components as it goes through the legislative process and encounters a wide range of hostile and friendly interest groups that try to smother the ideas.
Now, did Clinton have to scale back national service once he got elected? Scale back his proposal?
Practically within minutes of his election, he had to scale it back. The original scale of the plan talked about during the campaign would be something where anyone who wanted to pay back their college loans this way through community service would be able to. So that could be 500,000 people, a million people. They didn't really know, but it was on that order of magnitude. And that would be a program that would cost $8, $9, $10 billion a year. Once they got in and they saw the size of the deficit problem, they had to start scaling everything back. And in fact, they never really even considered proposing a national service plan the size that they talked about during the campaign. It was scaled back very early on to something in the $1 billion range, $2 billion range.
Your book, The Bill, is in part about special interests and what they do to legislation. So let's look at how the special interests went about preserving their own interests in this national service bill. Let's look at the banking industry at first. What was at stake for the banking industry?
Well, in that second half of the promise, which sounds very simple, it's just to get a college loan and be able to pay it back as a percentage of income over time. I refer to that plan through the book as pay-as-you-can loans. And Clinton liked the idea because it meant that if you had a lot of loan debt, you wouldn't be deterred from, you know, becoming a Head Start teacher or a nurse or a relatively low-paying profession, that you'd still be able to do that and have affordable payments because rather than being a fixed payment tied to the amount of the loan, it would be a variable payment tied to whatever you were earning in a given year. The problem with that was that it was too hard to administer under the current loan system, which is a bank-based system. Currently, basically, banks give out the loans, and they get guarantees from the federal government. And it's a very complicated system. It's been this way for a couple of decades. And in order to do this policy reform, Clinton would actually have to scrap the entire student aid system along the way. And that meant that the banks and other financial institutions that had a stake in the existing program and were doing quite nicely off it would lose a lot of money. And in this case, it was kind of a classic interest group drama, interest group that had become comfortable and was doing well off the current government program, was fighting like hell to keep the status quo.
What did they do to fight for what they wanted?
They basically used every lobbying trick in the book to try to preserve things, and that ranged from, in the more conventional sense, they just hired a very impressive roster of Washington influence peddlers and lobbyists, with an emphasis, incidentally, on getting big-name Democrats to lobby the Democratic Congress and the Democratic administration. That was one thing they did, but they also did something which is really much more typical of the way lobbying works now, which is they went to great efforts to organize or orchestrate grassroots, quote-unquote, lobbying efforts. It's really become very common here. It is the dominant form of lobbying, really more important than the back room sort of slipping something in the bill behind closed doors type of lobbying. And they were very aggressive at that. In particular, what they tried to do is get allies from outside the banking industry. I mean, they knew that they had a limited amount of credibility with the legislators because people just figured, well, they're just out to protect their own interests. So they had to find allies who didn't seem to have a vested interest in it.
And what allies did they find?
The most effective ones were the financial aid officers at local colleges. These are the people on the front line, people who actually do the paperwork, who fill out the loans, who work with the students. And the banks and their allies would send out SWAT teams to local colleges to give briefings to these local financial aid administrators and sort of help scare the dickens out of them. And the financial aid administrators had some legitimate concerns about this. They'd spent the previous 10 years learning how to master this very arcane financial aid system, and here we were going to have scrapped the entire system, have the Department of Education take it over and give out the money directly to the schools. So they were very worried about it, and they weighed in on behalf of the banks and on behalf of preserving the current student loan system.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Waldman. He covers Congress for Newsweek and is the author of the book The Bill, How the Adventures of Clinton's National Service Bill Reveal What is Corrupt, Comical, Cynical, and Noble About Washington. Now, what did labor have to say about national service?
The unions feared that if you had service programs getting, having a young person, say, working to clean up parks, that that would displace existing unionized employees who already work for the Parks Department. And the Parks Department would look at them, well, hey, if we can get some young guy to come in and clean up the parks for a third of the price or a third of the wage, well, then we'll just hire them. Why hire people at this higher unionized rate? So the unions pushed very hard for provisions in the bill that would prevent the new program from doing types of service that would displace jobs from existing unionized employees. And they were largely successful in getting that language in the bill very early on when the administration was writing the legislation.
In looking at how special influence changed the shape of Clinton's National Service Bill, would you say that special interest groups, when put together, represent the larger interests of American citizens?
No, which is not to say they don't have good arguments in the particular. And this is really an important point, I think, to understand the way Washington works. Special interest groups are not all greedy people working solely for their own pecuniary gain. Very often, each special interest group has a very legitimate argument on the merits. In the particular, and I'll give you one example that I think shows this as well as anything else. They decided to set up a structure for this program that would be very decentralized. Most of the money would be given out not by the federal government, but by independent state commissions appointed by the state governors. And they thought, well, we'll have this be a bipartisan commissions. And each state would have one. And when the White House made its proposal, they suggested that these commissions have between seven and 13 members. And they made a couple of extra points. They said, well, to assuage the unions, we'll guarantee that one of the commissioners has to represent labor. And to mollify some of the local governments that were worried that the governors might take over the commissions, we'll guarantee that a representative will come from local government. And they put a couple of other guarantees like that on. And that was just the White House proposal. Once the interest groups saw that the White House was putting some seats set aside for particular groups, then everyone lined up to demand equal treatment. A group called Young People for National Service, they got a quota for a person between age 16 and 25. Senior citizens groups got a guaranteed slot for an elderly person. Public schools got a guaranteed slot for themselves. And that was just the Senate. And then the House had its own list of people. They said if labor is going to get a slot, then business should also get a slot. And it went on and on like this. And when you added it all up, for this 13-person commission, you already had 14 guaranteed slots. And it became a farce. And this was before you even got to making the commissions bipartisan and diverse with respect to race, ethnicity, age, gender, and disability characteristics. So naturally, the solution that Congress came up with was to enlarge the commissions from 13 to 25 to accommodate all these different interest groups' demands. And this, to me, was a fascinating process because every one of those interest groups had a legitimate argument. The seniors argued that, look, we have this. We shouldn't just be talking about young people. There are millions of seniors who've already volunteered and they have a lot of time to volunteer. They should be a part of this. Well, that was true. And you had young people arguing, well, you know, most of the people in this program are going to be young. We ought to have someone, a young person, in the decision-making process. Well, that was true, too. And in fact, all of them had legitimate arguments. And the problem is that the sum of legitimate narrow interest does not necessarily add up to the public interest. And in this case, with the state commissions, you can see it rather clearly when it became a kind of a comic farce. But you could see that in other issues as well.
Stephen Waldman is my guest. He covers Congress for Newsweek, and he's the author of a new book called The Bill. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stephen Waldman. He covers Congress for Newsweek, and he's the author of the new book, The Bill, How the Adventures of Clinton's National Service Bill Reveal What is Corrupt, Comic, Cynical, and Noble About Washington. You know, we haven't even dealt with what happened in Congress yet. You write about what the preparations were like for a congressional debate on Clinton's National Service Bill. And his people were predicting all kinds of amendments banning gays from participating, amendments saying health insurance wouldn't be allowed to use for abortion, there could be random drug testing of participants. How many of these predicted amendments were actually proposed?
Well, it ended up being a different set of equally irksome amendments. I don't think they ended up proposing the gay ban out of national service, but in the case of national service, after it had gone through all these interest group gauntlets, it then hit a Republican filibuster in the Senate. The Republicans, even though there were four Republican co-sponsors of the legislation and they'd gotten a few other Republican votes, when it came time to pass the legislation on the floor of the Senate, a group of conservative senators realized that they had enough votes to block the legislation. So they began a filibuster. And this is when you started to see some of the greatest amount of chaos in the system. In the Senate, unlike the House, they don't have to tell you what amendments they're going to do ahead of time. They can just stand up and offer an amendment, and that'll be the first you hear of it. So you have to prepare for everything. In fact, one of the amendments that was offered to the National Service Bill was one by Jesse Helms having to do with the Daughters of the Confederacy and whether or not they should have an official government imprimatur. And it had nothing to do with national service, but then again, amendments don't have to have anything to do with the bills they're going on. And that led to a threatened filibuster by Carol Mosley Braun, the senator from Illinois, on top of the filibuster that was already going on national service, a filibuster within a filibuster. So all hell was breaking loose, and it became rather comic at times, and you really had to shake your head in amazement that this is the way laws are made.
So how does the bill that President Clinton proposed compare to the bill that passed after it went through the gauntlet of special interests and congressmen?
Well, for one thing, obviously it's quite a bit smaller in scale. The original campaign promise was talking about 500,000 people, 750,000 people serving. Right now we have about 30,000 people. So it's quite a bit smaller by comparison. On the other hand, it is already, just in its first year, bigger than the Peace Corps was at its peak. So it's still a fairly significant achievement. The scholarship level was supposed to be in the campaign. They had said if you do a year of service, you would get a $10,000 scholarship. And that was designed to be that high because they thought it would be important to help people pay for private college as well as public college, and it would be important. It needed to be that high to attract middle-class kids. And that eventually got knocked down all the way down to $4,800. So that's another important difference.
Are there any really obvious things that you would change if you were given the power to reform Congress?
There's one thing that I think has gotten overlooked a little bit in talking about the first 100 days of the Republican Congress. Putting aside the substance of what Gingrich and his allies have done, the contract, in a sense, was one of the most effective tools for dealing with interest group dynamics that I've seen so far.
How did it help in dealing with special interest groups?
In this sense, Gingrich was able to say, when interest groups were coming, pleading for different favors on the contract, Gingrich was able to say, and other members, more importantly, other members of Congress were able to say, look, I'd love to help you on that. I'll be there, you know, in the second 200 days. But we've got to keep our eye on the contract. We have to pass that. We signed our name on the dotted line here, and voters will punish us if we don't do it. Now, you know, in some cases, what they wanted to do was open the committee table to the interest group lobbyists, and they did that, because ideologically they wanted to. But the idea of having a set out legislative agenda that the public knows about during the congressional elections, that there's some expectation that people will be held to that, is actually an effective way of dealing with interest group pressure.
Newt Gingrich and the Contract with America provided this whole sense of theater about the Congress that I think it's lacked in the recent past. So has that made your job more interesting?
They certainly were quite good at orchestrating this and quite good at keeping discipline. You know, it's really, in a way, it's become more like covering the White House, where the White House always, or at least since President Reagan mastered the technique, all issues were very carefully orchestrated, messages were carefully orchestrated, and the job of the White House reporter was always to find out what was going on behind the scenes. What were the ideological struggles? What were the real reasons that things ended up in particular ways? Congress was usually more of an open book. Now, because Gingrich has imposed more discipline on his own party and kept to a more rigorous schedule, you have to do more behind-the-scenes reporting about how things are actually working. How did this get in the contract? How did it end up that this provision stayed in and that provision didn't? Because usually you could look at the committee markups and hearings and you could figure that out. Now a lot of those decisions are being made behind closed doors among the congressional leadership. So it becomes a little bit more, in some ways it's a harder, it's easier in the sense there's more drama. He has big climactic votes, and that makes it easier to create a sense of drama, but it's harder in the sense that a lot of the real decision-making is happening behind closed doors.
Do you have a sense of what Republican congressmen actually feel about Newt Gingrich now, whether he's a popular leader, whether he's resented because of the discipline that he's trying to maintain over the members of the House?
I think initially he was resented for that, particularly, you know, the ones who directly felt it, who, you know, didn't have as much flexibility in what they were going to do on their committees and that kind of thing. But right now, there is a sense of awe. There really is, even among the members of Congress. It's awe combined with a sense of anxiety that sometimes he seems about to lose it, Gingrich does, and seems to go too far out in his rhetoric. But basically, they're quite impressed. And I think he has built up a lot of capital with his own members because he can now say, look, I know I jammed this in your face. I know I told you you couldn't do this or you couldn't do that, but look what we got accomplished. So, you know, bear with me, and we'll, you know, in a way, the best sign for Gingrich is that both the moderates and the conservatives, when you talk to them privately, think Gingrich is their guy, watching out for their interests in the private councils. I think that there's enough personal suspicion of Gingrich and his ego. Everyone there recognizes the guy has a huge ego. There's enough personal suspicion that I think if they start having some legislative losses, that his popularity among the members will plummet rapidly. But for now, they really do have the sense of nothing succeeds like success, and you got to hand it to them. And they came from the minority party for 40 years, and with Gingrich's leadership, pulled off really more than they imagined they could in the first 100 days.
Stephen Waldman, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure. I appreciate it.
Stephen Waldman is congressional correspondent for Newsweek and author of the new book, The Bill. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.